Hello and welcome to today's episode. I'm going to be talking about the Save Live Comedy campaign that the Live Comedy Association has launched. Probably seen a lot of the press. We did a comprehensive industry-wide survey, the largest of its kind, and talking about the impact that the pandemic has had on the live comedy industry. And here's some of the key findings. Almost one in five people working in all corners of the industry will have to quit by August. Given another year, three quarters will have to leave. Three quarters of the industry will have to leave if there's another year of live comedy being on ice. I won't leave. I'm a cockroach. I'll be clinging on to dear life, even if it drives me into absolute financial ruin. I will still be there, clinging on, trying to stay relevant in the eyes of the comedy-going public, which won't exist if, you know, the venues sink at the rate that they're sinking. And we probably won't see a lot of this $1.57 billion rescue package. We seem to have fallen through all of the safety nets. And I spoke in a bonus podcast about that. Seemed like a big moment. It seemed like we might finally get a bit of help. The government will help us to revive our industry, but I don't think that is going to be the case. So we have to take it upon ourselves. Being the industrious, innovative, DIY operators that we are going to have to save live comedy ourselves. And I think we'll always find a way to do comedy in some form, but making a consistent living off of it, that's another matter. But if we keep shouting about it and making the case to people who value art only in terms of money, that the massive stars, the comedy circuit spat out, that they generate work and wealth for the nation in exchange for no investment from the state whatsoever, then maybe they'll realise it's their turn to give something back. Those most likely to be thinking of leaving come from underrepresented groups, including women, LGBTQ members, the disabled or working class people like myself. Unfortunately, we don't have the financial ballast. Is ballast the right word? Just checking. Heavy material carried temporarily or permanently in a vessel. Anything that gives mental, moral, or political stability or steadiness. Yes, we don't have the financial ballast to keep us, to sustain us, to keep us propped up during these times of economic ruin, where we're not able to generate any income from live performance. Those promoting gigs or helping them operate are most likely to consider quitting. They also are most likely to be earning less than $12,000 a year from comedy before lockdown. Yeah, promoting gigs, I do that as well. A lot of comedians, they wear different hats. One of my hats is also as a gig promoter, and it's very rare you make a return or a decent return off of that. I did one of my fondest comedy memories was I did four sold out shows at Vault Festival in 2019 of Pope's Addiction Clinic. And that was the first time I actually made a substantial return on gigs that I've actually put on myself. And it's also a fun comedy memory because we opened up one of the shows. Me and my mum opened it up with us sitting on stage and her lecturing me. Not lecturing, actually. It was quite a civil conversation. Me and my mum chatting about how my drug addiction affected the family. Really funny and poignant. And throughout the whole of the run of these shows, people were, you know, crying and laughing. Like, I know a solid dyed in the wool club comic came up to me after doing his set where we encourage people to sort of go off-piste and let the belly of their id hang out to avoid doing material and just talk, like campfire confessional. And he was hilarious. And then there was a moment where he unexpectedly started welling up. Not the type of man who would do that easily, even on his own, let alone in front of a paying crowd. And came off stage afterwards and said, like, "Oh, Pope Man, what the fuck are you doing to me? It's a very powerful show. It was unexpected that it stirred all this emotion in me." So that was a very powerful moment. Another one of my dearest memories of live comedy performance was doing a set about drug addiction and me ramming a bar of soap up my anus because I accidentally broke a woodlouse's pregnancy sack, doing that set to children. And if you look at my Twitter and on my Facebook and stuff, you'll see a picture of the moment that I traumatized a little collection of kids. I don't think they were traumatized. They found it very funny. They were really enjoying asking me questions about stuff that, you know, on the face of it is probably quite adult. But I feel like actually I got confirmation that I dealt with it in a way that was delicate and avoided corrupting their innocence. So the parents came up to me afterwards and said, you know, we was a bit worried, a bit ambivalent about the topics of exploration in your set, especially to very tiny 7-year-old children. But you handled it in a way that was good. That was accessible to children. Didn't ruin them. I think that's why with my book proposal, I think the overarching theme of the book is permitting the transgressive anti-establishment behaviours of the people you're caring for. That's it. That's the main thrust. And the notion of agency is an act of liberation. And I want to restore to those who seem powerless their individual rights to act effectively upon the world. That includes elders who have dementia, people with disabilities, with brain disorders, and also children who sort of have brain disorder. I mean, their brains are barely formed, inchoate, sort of mushy little ready-brick brains. So they're sort of half-human kids, aren't they? They haven't fully realized themselves. They're not sitting comfortably in themselves, are they? Because they're growing. But actually, in their own way, they're probably sitting comfortably in themselves more than any adult ever could. Because they haven't got the accompanying wisdom of what the world is about. And the feverish apocalypticist moment that we're in at the moment, we're in during lockdown. They're not aware of the larger picture. So, and they do have insecurities, kids, but not. Like, I think they feel a bit insecure if adults are seen to sort of disregard what they're saying. They sort of seem, they might feel a bit silly, which is why you should talk to kids on their terms or on our terms by telling them about the time you popped a bar of soap up your ass, you broke a woodlouse's. I've actually found it's called a brood pouch rather than a pregnancy sack, but it's a brood pouch on stage. People are going to ask questions. Because it's not obvious what a brood pouch is. It's like what kangaroos have. So wood lice are, I mean, I don't really know how evolution works, but I'd say that there's wood lice and kangaroos are close cousins. A kangaroo is an evolved woodlouse. because that's how evolution works. So it's retained some of its woodlouse essence, but then it's become a whole other thing. Sort of upright dog that punches. But yeah, that's why I let a lot of the people I care for throw an apple or pull the curtains down. It shakes them out of institutionalization and reacquaints them with their ludic selves. And this has a huge overlap with comedy. Comedy is a dialogue. This is from Sophie Quirk's amazing book, Why Stand-Up Matters, How Comedians Manipulate and Influence. And stand-up is a dialogue. It requires the active participation of its audience, which is why audiences who come and enjoy the comedy should now raise awareness about our plight, about the plight of our industry. Because if you are someone who consumes comedy, you have to do your fucking bit now. Properly. You have to shout from the rooftops and make sure this industry doesn't sink. And I know quite a few people, they consume their comedy through television, which cuts out a lot of the really electric, charged, extraneous bits of live performance. The bits where you go off script, or stuff happens in the room. You learn how to occupy and use the space that you're in. So sometimes you'll find a little nook. You'll go off stage, find a little nook, and crouch into that little nook at the back of the room behind the audience and do the rest of the show from there, like I did in 2016. And you'd think it would create a sense of occasion, because you've stripped the artifice of performance. You've come off the stage, you're behind the audience, you're out of sight, you're in a little burrow. People can hear you, but they can't see you. But apparently it's not actually, it didn't quite create the sense of occasion, the interesting, charged moment that I anticipated. Just everyone was bored and mildly irritated, peeved. Everyone was peeved, mate. You come out of that nook and then you're facing an audience that are peeved. But not even peeved to the point that they feel they have to say something. Just peeved, like it's bubbling under the surface. And they're like, hey, if he does one more false move, I am going to be quite vocal about this. But he's come out of the nook, so I'm hoping he's learned his lesson. Because I did not pay to see this shit. It's fine. He's back on stage. He's talking about bloody shoving soap up his ass. I am not having any more of this. I am not. I'm sick of this. I'm sick of this. Imagine dealing with that from an audience. Actually, you know what? Fuck live performance, mate. If that's the kind of audiences you're going to be, do you know what? I want it to die. No, I don't really. I don't want it to die as an industry. I want them audience members to die. I'm hoping that they've been sloughed off the top of the population by coronavirus. I don't want them to die. Everyone's got their own preferences, what they like in comedy. But the thing I sort of love about comedy is it's abjection. And abjection can refer to a number of, this is now from the dark side of stand-up comedy. Abjection can refer to a number of different phenomena. Most frequently, it describes bodily fluids and other matter we expel and cast aside. We shed urine, feces, and other bodily matter in order to live. But in doing so, we remove something that is part of ourselves. As this matter separates from the body, we come to see it as non-living material, which ultimately reminds us of our own immortality. Some people too are abject because they are similarly expelled from the social body. Drug addicts, for instance, like myself, or underpaid carers as well. Funny how something that's deemed to be unskilled labour requires a person who works in an environment where they tend to another human being's most intimate needs. That's considered unskilled labour. I've like said it myself. There's an artistry to caregiving. I can turn the changing of an incontinence pad into a Japanese tea ceremony. Truly an artistry to it. People look down on that. Look down on addicts. Some people are too abject because they, as I said, similarly expelled from the social body. This category applies generally to people at the margins of society, including the homeless, mentally ill, and addicts. This chapter from the book, The Dark Side of Stand-Up Comedy, uses Craig Ferguson's monologue to demonstrate these different understandings of objection and suggest a new category of temporal objection that describes the experience of alcoholic blackouts, since they separate an aspect of the addict's past from a larger body of memories. This goes with the type of war stories that you talk about in AA and NA. This is also the thing about stand-up comedy that I love, because stand-up comedy allows abject marginal figures like myself to exist on their own terms. I once diarrheaed on stage, not on the stage, like in my pants, accidentally. I was going through withdrawal. I got invited to the anniversary of a really great venue. Another great venue that's experiencing financial precarity, might be wiped out of existence because of the pandemic. This is my first ever place that performed as well. And I got invited there for an anniversary show by the person who owns it. And I diarrheaed into my pants on stage. And had two choices. I could ignore the diarrhea, but risk the smell of the diarrhea escaping, and then people smelling I'd sharted, but that I didn't have enough self-awareness to acknowledge the shart. So after diarrheaing on stage, I then referred to the diarrhea, very present, very palpable slurry. But the immediacy of being able to communicate your bodily dysfunction in real time to a paying audience, that's live comedy. Just being able to talk about your diarrhea as it happens. Even providing the commentary of the route that the diarrhea is taking. And it's got to the back of the thigh at this point. It's slipping down. And I mean, again, I don't know if that audience enjoyed that experience, but it creates a sort of fun tension. But I think that one, they actually did enjoy it. There's Stuart Lee in the book, The Punk Turn in Comedy, Masks of Anarchy. There's a quote from him where, is it 154? Is it this one? Oh, shit, I've done the... Oh, it's in this... Ah, that's right, the wrong book. It's in Why Stand-Up Matters, back to that one. So Stuart Lee said, well, in a club, right? I can't do it, Stuart Lee. In a club, right, in somewhere like the Comedy Store or Jonglers, there'll be a guy talking about things and the people in the audience nudge each other going, that's what you're like. You say that. Oh, I did that. Whereas what I like, and this is what I like as well, what I love, in fact, is I like to be in an audience going, I would never have thought of that, or I would never have said that, or why would you possibly think that? right? That's what I like. I like to be taken by surprise. So I think it depends what people want. And I get that a lot. I get 3/4 of the audience. Sometimes all of them are bloody loving it, but 3/4 of the audience are really enjoying it. And then you get the odd, you know, few people. Sometimes it's all the people, if I'm honest, but rarely. But you get a smattering of people who look and sort of do this like, what? What? Why did you do that? Why are you telling us that you did that sort of face? And that's what I like. And in now the punk turning comedy Masks of Anarchy, in page 203, just sort of going back to the theme of shit. So Roy Chubby Brown, he remarks that he had always purveyed his brand of sex and shit humour, yet it did not fit the blue conventions of the 1970s. So the implication that what actually changed with Roy Chubby Brown was the climate of receptivity rather than his comedy. This change coincided with alt-com, even though he was, or the alt-comedy crowd was massively in opposition to what Roy Chubby Brown was doing. He was becoming successful. Well, they were becoming successful, but he was becoming successful with a different type of crowd. And Chubby tended to opt for the polar opposite of a euphemism. This is what can't abide a lot of Roy Chubby Brown stuff. Don't like the racist stuff. Don't like the sexist stuff. But this is the part of his act that I do absolutely love. And I think, again, we need to embrace this. And this is another argument for why we should save live comedy. Chubby tend to drop for the polar opposite of a euphemism. There ought to be a word for substitute expressions that are uglier than the conventional Anglo-Saxon, comments Ben Thompson, attempting to describe Chubby's technique. Testicles, 1-2 testicles, makes for a reversal of the carry-on style of seizing upon any opportunity for a suggestive innuendo. So Roy Chubby Brown burst through innuendo. Like he couldn't contain the base, the mucky, the cack of his psyche, and so yeah, didn't have to use the window dressing of euphemism. He could just throw it out there. And I always find that another exciting part of comedy. So we've launched a campaign to save live comedy. And you can go and savelivecomedy.co.uk, I believe. I can't find anything to say. So yeah, live. Go on the Live Comedy Association website, and then there'll be a link to Save Live Comedy website, and there'll be an open letter there. Please sign that open letter. This is an urgent appeal to my listeners to support comedy in a very vocal, very proactive way. And thank you for the continuing listenership of this. I've been a bit all over the place for this one, a bit babbly, but I apologize. Longer than usual. I could probably cut a bit out, but I can't be, don't know how. So love you all very much. Thanks again for listening.